The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purpose of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Program material may not be edited for use in promotional material by any political party or other organization, and may not be used in any edited form that could mislead or misinform an audience or viewer, or which does not present a balanced portrayal of the proceedings in the House. Video program material may only be used with its original audio components, and no other audio material may be added to video material used. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
Nova Scotians have secure and reliable internet access in their community for job searches, filing government forms, banking, and recreational use. And whereas the Conservatives' recent announcement that they will no longer support this community-based program will cause hardship for those Nova Scotians from all parts of the province who rely on CAP sites for internet access, therefore be it resolved that all members of this House, especially the members from Argyle, Hants West, Inverness, Victoria of the Lakes, Cape Breton West, Cape Breton North and Cumberland South, make it clear to the Conservatives that they do not support their cuts to these important local resources,
yep,
and ask them to reconsider their rash decision to isolate rural Nova Scotians. Mr. Speaker, I request waiver of notice and passage without debate.
There has been a request for waiver. Is it agreed? All those in favour say aye. No, I'm sorry. Motion is tabled. It is now 3:01. We will start orders of the day, oral question put by members to minister. We will finish at 4:31. I will now recognize the honourable member for Preston.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, May 4th marked the launch of the long-awaited AfroCentric Learning Institute. This institute was born out of the recommendations adopted by the government in 2003, the Black Learners Advisory Committee Implementation Review Report. Mr. Speaker, will the Minister of Education tell members of this House what this institute will be called?
The Honourable Minister of Education.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and thank you for bringing up such an important institute today. The AfroCentric Learning Institute was launched on this Friday, and it was a key recommendation of the Black Report. This is going to be a wonderful resource for our province. It is the first of its kind in Canada. Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Preston.
Mr. Speaker,
supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, the government's response to the report's recommendation states, quote, and I will table that document, the ALI has officially become the Desmore Buddy Day AfroCentric Learning Institute, end quote, and I will table that document. In the letter from the Minister of Education dated May 2nd, inviting the Day family to the May 4th launch, called it the Delmore Buddy Day AfroCentric Learning Institute, and I will table that letter as well. Will the Minister tell members of this House why, in the 2003 report and on the letter of May the 2nd letter, it was called the Desmore Buddy Day Institute, but the institute itself was incorporated into the AfroCentric Learning Institute?
The Honourable the Minister of Education.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. The AfroCentric Learning Institute, which was launched this Friday, is going to be a resource for all of our teachers and for our students here in Nova Scotia. I have to say that I did not know Mr. Day. I did not meet him, but I know that Mr. Day was instrumental in making sure that all people in the legislature, all parties, move forward the advancement of appropriate education for our Black learners in the province of Nova Scotia. And I have heard nothing but his commitment and his passion and dedication towards children of African descent receiving appropriate education. And Mr. Speaker, I recognize that there have been difficulties in the past, and we are continuing to with difficulties. And this institute is going to be a resource that will help us along our journey to make sure that our students in this province get an appropriate education. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Preston on his final supplementary.
Well, I have to ask the Minister why she wrote the letter then of May the 4th, the 2nd. The letter clearly said that this was going to be the Delmore Buddy Day Afrocentric Learning Institute. And the community, the black community, even went to the length of going all over this province checking to see if the name would be acceptable. And it was, by everyone that they met with in the province. So will the Minister of Education take this opportunity today to apologize to the Day family and to those who have worked so hard for Mr. Day's memory to see the Institute becomes a reality, and to all members of this House for insulting this name change?
The Honourable Minister of Education.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I want to say that past ministers and past boards wanted to recognize Mr. Day's contributions, but it has come to our attention that there's some conflicting information on the public record that needs to be sorted out, and there has been a new board established on Friday, and I'm sure that the new board will be able to sort this information out. Thank you.
The Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, my question is for the Premier. Yesterday, I tabled a statement from the Premier when he was in opposition in his House, where he said, and I quote again, "When the price of power starts to outstrip consumers' ability to pay, it's time for the government to step in. It's time for government to provide leadership and solutions." Well, Mr. Speaker, as we know, power rates continue to skyrocket in this province under this government, and at the same time, the disposable income of Nova Scotians has declined, most recently by 1.8%. My question to the Premier, why has he decided that it is no longer the responsibility of government to provide leadership when the price of power outstrips consumers' ability to pay? And I'll again table that statement.
Honourable the Premier.
Mr. Speaker, I saw the statement yesterday when it was tabled by the leader of the Conservative Party. He neglects to say that in the press release that he actually tables, that I actually point out the two things that should happen in order to show leadership, Mr. Speaker. This says two things that have to happen. First, Nova Scotia Power must move quickly to use more renewables, renewable energy like wind and tidal power. And secondly, help consumers with the one big thing they cannot do, which is conserve the amount of power they use. Mr. Speaker, that is the exact program of government that we have laid out. We are doing exactly what we said we would do.
The Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party on his first supplementary.
Well, Mr. Speaker, you'll have to forgive Nova Scotians who, when they heard the Premier tell them that when the price of power outstrips their ability to pay, that it's the government's job to step in, that they didn't notice that that promise, like so many others from him, contained a big magic asterisk, contained two conditions that he's now disclosing that were not part of the deal at the time, that he only means it under certain conditions, like the HST promise, like the balanced budget promise. Now his power rate promise, we find out later, had conditions attached to it all along. But, Mr. Speaker, one of those conditions that he is hanging his hat on now is that consumption has to go down. But the fact of the matter is, Mr. Speaker, according to Nova Scotia Power's filing yesterday, the average consumption for a Nova Scotia household in 2008 was 830 kilowatt hours of electricity. The average consumption today, after 3 years of this government, is 833 kilowatt hours of electricity. Consumption has not gone down. It has gone up. And yet our power prices continue to skyrocket, and it outstrips Nova Scotians' ability to pay, as the Premier had told them before the election. So my question to the Premier, why is he okay with skyrocketing power bills now when consumption has not gone down as he had put a condition on his earlier promise.
Honorable the Premier.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I guess unlike the leader of the Conservative Party, most Nova Scotians can actually read. They can read the whole text, Mr. Speaker. They, in fact, endorse the agenda of this government by voting for them. The most important decision they could make, Mr. Speaker. And more to the point is he uses 2008 as a year for comparison, knowing full well that Efficiency Nova Scotia was not in place at that time, and knowing full well that Alan Crandallmeyer appeared before the Public Accounts Committee and pointed out to the members opposite that more than $100 million in conservation savings were passed on to ratepayers as a result of their work.
Honourable the Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party on his final supplementary.
Well, Mr. Speaker, unfortunately for the Premier, Nova Scotians can read very well. They can read the election platform of the NDP, which said he wouldn't raise their taxes, that he would balance the budget. It said he would not let power rates go up. And they can now read for themselves these new conditions that he places retroactively on his promises, like that it depended on consumption. Well, Mr. Speaker, consumption has not gone down, but power prices have certainly skyrocketed. The only place where consumption is down is in the industrial sector because of shutdowns at big companies like New Page and like Bowater. And as we learned from the Nova Scotia Power filing yesterday, even consumption among other companies, large and small, is down, not because they honoured the Premier's magic conditional promise, but because they can't afford to pay for power like they used to be able to afford for pay for power, Mr. Speaker. The one place where consumption is down is in manufacturing, where jobs matter, where jobs are important, where jobs can be maintained. Here is a great example of where the Premier's electricity plan is actually reducing consumption by killing jobs in the manufacturing sector. And so my question to the Premier is, how many more shutdowns and job losses does he have to see before he admits his plan isn't working and he does show leadership and step in on behalf of Nova Scotians who can't afford their power bills?
Honourable the Premier.
Mr. Speaker, what the Nova Scotians know, and I hear it from them almost every day, is that unfortunately, because of decisions made by past governments, Nova Scotians, whether they are in the industrial sector or in the residential sector, are chained to the international fossil fuel market as a result of decisions made by those governments. We have higher electricity prices because of the decisions that previous governments made.
The Honourable Leader of the Official Opposition.
Well, thank you. I'll try to. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Nova Scotians are paying some of the highest rates for power in Canada, Mr. Speaker. Nova Scotia Power has gone back to the URB to try and exact more money from family and businesses. Nova Scotians have had enough, Mr. Speaker, and they're looking for this government to stand up to Nova Scotia Power. So my question to the Premier, will the Premier end Nova Scotia Power's monopoly to ensure competition with better regulations?
Honourable the Premier.
Mr. Speaker, the reality is that we have seen the results of deregulations in other parts of the country. What has happened with deregulation is it has actually driven up the cost of power for ordinary consumers. Unfortunately, the members of the Liberal Party believe that embarking on a deregulated market will somehow benefit ratepayers when, in fact, what it would do is harm them.
Order, please. Order, please. I'd ask the honourable member to retract those remarks that I just heard. The honourable member from Miramar, stand in your place, please.
Retracted, Mr. Speaker.
What you said.
What I said, yes.
Yes. Thank you. The honourable leader of the official opposition.
Mr. Speaker, I want to be clear that no time has the Liberal caucus ever suggested there should be deregulation, Mr. Speaker. What we've allowed for competition to happen in a regulated market, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I want to remind the Premier of all the provinces that he's quoting, they have cheaper power than we do here in Nova Scotia. The fact of the matter is, Mr. Speaker, is that the NDP government is afraid to stand up against Nova Scotia Power, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, They're afraid to allow competition in the energy market, Mr. Speaker, so Nova Scotians can get an opportunity to have choice when it comes to who supplies their household with power, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, they have the ability to put in a regulated market to allow competition inside the province of Nova Scotia. So my question for the Premier, why does the Premier continue to stand up for Nova Scotia power instead of standing up for Nova Scotia?
Honourable the Premier.
Mr. Speaker, we are standing up for ratepayers. We removed the HST from home electricity, something that that member and his entire caucus voted against, Mr. Speaker. I want to point out to the Leader of the Opposition that he should talk to his energy critic, because I will table again the legislation that he tabled, which calls for the deregulation of it, calls for the deregulation of the electricity market, and I will table a copy of the news report of the day when that legislation was tabled in New Brunswick, which says it's all about the deregulation of the market, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Leader of the Official Opposition on his final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, I would suggest before the Premier starts chastising the Leader of the Conservative Party about being able to read, I would suggest he goes back to racial class, Mr. Speaker. Because Mr. Speaker, in actual fact, that bill that was put in front of this House does not talk about deregulation, Mr. Speaker, and I can't help, nor can this caucus help, what is written in New Brunswick, Mr. Speaker. But what this government can do, what this government can do is keep their word, Mr. Speaker. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, since this government is unable and powerless to stand up against Nova Scotia power, perhaps it could give Nova Scotians a break on their power bill each and every month by doing what they said they would do before the last election, and that would be to force shareholders to pay for the NDP electricity tax and not ratepayers.
Honourable the Premier.
Mr. Speaker, we took tax off of electricity, not put it on, Mr. Speaker. What he wants to do, Mr. Speaker, is try and confuse consumers by telling them that the $100 million in energy savings that they received for the $40 million that were paid is not a good deal, Mr. Speaker. The $40 million of that money is recovered for $100 million worth of savings.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth East.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And my question is for the, my question is for the Premier, since he wants to get so angry about this, since he can't get his facts right yet. Mr. Speaker, yesterday, in response to a question from the member for Glace Bay, the Minister of Economic Development, his minister, said that some businesses in the province may be concerned about skyrocketing costs, about power rates in the province, but he didn't think it was really a big issue. So I'm going to table that. In the follow-up supplementary to the Minister of Energy, he said he knows people are concerned about energy rates in the province, and I'll table that. Mr. Speaker, which minister is right?
Honourable the Premier.
Mr. Speaker, we're all concerned about the cost of electricity, anything that affects the people's quality of life or the ability for a business to function. That is why, Mr. Speaker, we have embarked on a program, one that was widely lauded throughout the industry, an electricity plan that will invest $1.5 billion over the next number of years in order to make improvements into the electricity grid that will mean that this province will finally be taken off of fossil fuels, placed on renewables, so that we have stable long-term pricing. Mr. Speaker, that's not just a goal. That is something that this government is actually doing.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth East on his first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, before the Premier starts blaming the other parties for the reliance on coal in this province, he might want to talk to the member for Cape Breton Centre, who lobbied hard for coal in this House and as an NDP MLA. And we tabled lots of that the other day. So, Mr. Speaker, all three parties were fighting for coal in this province, including members of the NDP. You know, Mr. Speaker, the NDP ministers stand in this House day after day, and they take credit for the amazing economic growth in this province that has happened since they took office. So amazing, in fact, it is 0.3% growth, the worst in Canada. Amazingly bad. Mr. Speaker, since the minister's cabinet colleague, the energy minister's colleague, said that there are only some businesses that may be concerned about skyrocketing power rates, and the Minister of Energy thought, well, maybe everybody is, would the Premier please tell us which businesses in this province his cabinet colleagues feel aren't worried about power rates?
Honourable the Premier.
Mr. Speaker, we're three questions deep into question period, and he's already reduced to rhetoric, Mr. Speaker. That's because he has nothing left. He knows that it is this government, Mr. Speaker, that are standing up for its citizens, ensuring that we have stable long-term energy prices so that this will become an economic advantage for the people of Nova Scotia.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth East on his final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, the Premier is worried about rhetoric and he gives that answer. I mean, that's unbelievable. You know, Mr. Speaker, the fact is this Premier isn't standing up for ratepayers. He's standing up for Nova Scotia Power, the only company in the province that isn't concerned about rising power rates. You know, Mr. Speaker, let's take a look at some of these business users. The efficiency charge that the Premier said during the election they would charge against shareholders to get that $100 million in savings is increasing by 249% this year on bills. The rate is going up 249% in that application for industrial users. Now, the HST changes that this government likes to talk about were relevant to businesses because businesses, it was a charge through anyways, so it doesn't matter. The minister talks about switching to renewables when he knows that the costs associated with those changes that we've paid up to now were from the Tory government's EGSPA legislation, and the NDP costs will come later. So, Mr. Speaker, what has this government done to reduce power rates, as they said was so important, for businesses in Nova Scotia?
Honourable the Premier.
Mr. Speaker, we have entered into agreements that will ensure stable long-term rates so that those will become an economic advantage for Nova Scotia businesses. The reality is despite what has been said in the last couple of days, Nova Scotia does not have the highest power rates in the country. In fact, we're in the middle of the pack. And the other thing that's something that has been avoided to be mentioned by the leaders of the other parties is simply this. We also have one of the lowest basic charges in the country.
The Honourable Member for Hants West.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the province's pulp and paper crisis is creating a spiraling electricity problem in our province. High electricity costs were cited as one of the three major cost drivers that were making it difficult for them to keep their doors open. Ironically, the shutdown leads to even higher energy prices. Mr. Speaker, my question to the Minister of Energy, will he rewrite his expensive electricity plan and replace it with one that sustains important manufacturing jobs rather than driving them away?
Honourable Minister of Energy.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And certainly, you know, as was mentioned in the last question, we are all concerned about the cost or the affordability of energy in this province, whether for a family or for a very large industry. And we continue to work to find alternatives to expensive coal that has really been the cost driver of higher energy prices, thanks to previous governments. We're working on a suite of alternatives from renewables to natural gas to efficiency programs to taking the HST off electricity, a whole variety or whole suite of alternatives that will make electricity affordable in this province.
The Honourable Member for Hants West on his first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, year after year, these mills made big contributions to fixed costs of Nova Scotia's electricity system. They helped pay the mortgage on the power plants, the wind turbines, the dams, and the power lines that have been built. But these mills exit the system. It's forcing everyone else to pay more to cover these fixed costs. It's a spiral effect that is just going to keep getting worse, Mr. Speaker. Will the Minister of Energy tell us how many more jobs we will have to lose in rural Nova Scotia before he will admit his bite-the-bullet electricity plan is actually killing important manufacturing jobs?
The Honourable Minister of Energy.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Through our 2010 renewable electricity plan, we have an outline of a better way for a better future. And working with large businesses, small businesses, families, renters, the whole gamut of Nova Scotians, and we have various programs under the efficiency model, that efficiency Nova Scotia model, that will help all of those ratepayers that I just mentioned.
The Honourable Member for Hants West on his final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, yesterday in question period, the Minister of Economic and Rural Development and Tourism said the cost of power may be an issue for some businesses. Well, Mr. Speaker, according to the Canadian Federation of Independent Businesses Business Barometer for March, the main cost pressure facing Nova Scotia businesses is fuel and energy, followed by taxes and regulation. And I'll table that document, Mr. Speaker. Under the NDP's watch, we have now the highest rate per kilowatt hour for power of all the provinces and some of the highest taxes, Mr. Speaker. Will the minister tell job creators which he would prefer them to do to deal with their rising cost pressures? Lay off more employees or pay their power bills?
The Honourable Minister of Energy.
Mr. Speaker, the real reason that energy prices are high is because of years of inaction by previous governments that just did not have a plan, did not have a vision for. And on the contrary, this government does have a plan. It's our renewable electricity plan. We're working towards renewables, working towards more natural gas, efficiency Nova Scotia programs. There's a whole suite of alternatives to help Nova Scotians, to help businesses in this province. Thank you.
The Honourable Leader of the Official Opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Speaker, today the province released a physician resource plan that confirmed, Mr. Speaker, what many others have been telling this government for quite some time, that we do not have a sufficient number of family physicians today, Mr. Speaker, and by 2020, the need will have grown by more than 120 physicians. While recruitment and retention is complex, it became clearly evident today what we've been doing in terms of recruitment and retention is not working. Given all that what has been confirmed today, Mr. Speaker, my question for the Premier, will the Premier commit to passing our bill, which would set aside 20 medical seats at Dalhousie Medical School for students who are willing to work in underserviced areas across our province?
Honourable the Premier.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I understand the Minister of Health today had a press conference along with Doctors Nova Scotia, in which Doctors Nova Scotia talked about the great level of cooperation they had with the Minister of Health. I think she may would like to respond directly to that question, so I'm going to ask her to respond.
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I want to thank the Honourable Member for the question. Mr. Speaker, our government is committed to ensuring that every Nova Scotian has access to a family doctor in primary care, regardless of where they live throughout throughout our province. Today was a very good day for health care in the province of Nova Scotia, Mr. Speaker. We are the first province to have a physician resource plan. We've worked very hard with our partners at the medical school, Doctors Nova Scotia, the college, the DHAs, and Mr. Speaker, we have the first steps moving us forward to expand primary care, 4 new primary health care centres in the province, financial assistance for 16 others, a new locum program to support emergency rooms. There are many, many excellent features in our new physician resource plan, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Leader of the Official Opposition on his first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, 3 years later, we have a plan, and Mr. Speaker, and 60,000 Nova Scotians are still waiting to have access to a family physician. Mr. Speaker, today, both Doctors Nova Scotia and Dal Med School talked about the need to introduce med students to the reality of rural practices, Mr. Speaker. 40 med schools throughout the world have comprehensive third-year clerkship programs that have been very successful in introducing students to the realities of rural medicine and then attracting these students, Mr. Speaker, back to the very communities in this province and other provinces who have difficulty accessing and recruiting family physicians. So my question to the Premier, will the Premier commit to passing our bill, which would support Dalhousie Medical School so that they can implement a third-year comprehensive clerkship program?
Honourable the Premier.
Again, Mr. Speaker, I'll ask the Minister of Health to respond to the Leader of the Opposition.
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, one of the things that this government will be doing this year is expanding the residency program from the medical school into the Annapolis Valley, where that member represents members of the public there. And we will work very closely with Dalhousie. Dalhousie have been a full partner in the development of the Physician Resource Plan, and they are very committed to working with the department and others to changing the mix of graduates that come out of their program to refocus into more family practice and more generalists that will be able to work throughout our province and take some of the pressure off the Capital District Health Authority and our ERs, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Leader of the Official Opposition on his final supplementary.
What Dalhousie Medical School has been clear about is the fact that the clerkship residency program, Mr. Speaker, which has worked in other provinces, would be a tremendous asset to Nova Scotia. And that is different, Mr. Speaker. And that is different, Mr. Speaker, than the residency program that the Minister is talking about. The clerkship program takes place in the third and fourth year of studies, Mr. Speaker. The residency program takes after they graduate, Mr. Speaker. But, Mr. Speaker, the residency program highlights another issue that happens in this province, Mr. Speaker, and in our country. There are 3,500 Canadians at any one time studying medical schools abroad, Mr. Speaker. About 100 Nova Scotians are part of that, Mr. Speaker. But when they look for a residency program, residency seat in Nova Scotia, we treat them as foreign students. We do not show them the respect of treating them as one of our sons and daughters. Mr. Speaker, I would ask the Minister and the Premier to support our bill, which is in front of this House, which is to build a residency program that addresses the very need to support those sons and daughters of ours who are studying abroad in this province of Nova Scotia, Mr. Speaker.
Honourable the Premier.
Mr. Speaker, as the Minister of Health just pointed out, there is an enhanced residency project underway that will expand the residency program in those areas of the valley, Mr. Speaker. I'm sure now, though, that the Leader of the Opposition regrets the last Liberal government when they were making cuts to those things like seats.
The Honourable Member for Hants West.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, Nalcor and Emera deal on Muskrat Falls was due the end of January and is over 3 months late. Can't hear myself think, Mr. Speaker. Thank you.
I hear you.
Mr. Speaker, the Nalcor and Emera...
Listen carefully.
The Nalcor and Emera deal on Muskrat Falls was due the end of January, Mr. Speaker, and is over 3 months late. Through the current proposals, Nova Scotia would be entitled to about 160 megawatts of energy. However, the subsea cable is expected to hold up to more than three times that capacity. We see today that the Premier has finally come around to our caucus's position that there needs to be a formal review of the project, but there are still many concerns about securing a market for the extra electricity. Mr. Speaker, my question to the Minister of Energy, has his department talked to Emera about markets for excess energy for Muskrat Falls, and what would that mean for Nova Scotia?
The Honourable Minister of Energy.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Certainly the Muskrat Falls project is a real opportunity for Nova Scotia. It's going to provide 35 years of stable electricity rates for Nova Scotians, and that'll help small businesses, large business, families, and there will be a certain contracted amount of power available once the UARB decides on the format. But the extra power that's there, that'll be available at market prices to Nova Scotians and beyond.
The Honourable Member for Hants West on his first supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. A market for the excess energy is key to helping that project get off the ground. Nova Scotia could benefit from moving that electricity through our province. But if there's no market willing to pay the premium price for electricity, then it becomes stranded here, forcing up power rates even more. My question to the Minister, has Emera asked the government to accept more than the 20% of our energy needs from Muskrat Falls to make sure there is a market for the expensive energy in order to force its deal with Nalcor to work?
The Honourable Minister of Energy.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As the Premier has been intimately involved in this project, I'm going to ask him to respond to it.
Honourable the Premier.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I want to begin by pointing out that right from the very first day that the Memorandum of Understanding was signed, we said there would be a full review before the Utility and Review Board, something that today the legislation set out the terms of, Mr. Speaker. I would point out to the member opposite that we will have an entitlement to a certain set amount of electricity. The rest of that will continue to belong to the province of Newfoundland through their Crown agency, Nalcor. They will run that through into the competitive market in an enhanced transmission grid. That will be also be good for the province of Nova Scotia. It's part of the reason that New Brunswick has been intricately involved in the overall transmission project. I would point out that one of the advantages for the province of Nova Scotia is that the transmission line that will be used to carry that extra electricity will actually charge a tolling rate on the electricity as it passes through, which will help underwrite the cost of the transmission system.
The Honourable Member for Hants West on his final supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, Maine has an excess of cheap natural gas, fueled electricity, and there is not yet a link to the more profitable markets in Boston or New York. They may have no reason to buy more expensive electricity, and I bet customers in New England won't buy Muskrat Falls energy without knowing the cost. Mr. Speaker, my question to the Premier, is he committed to even more electricity for Muskrat Falls without knowing how much it costs?
Honourable the Premier.
Mr. Speaker, one of the great benefits of Muskrat Falls is, as I said, we're going to get a guaranteed rate for 35 years for the amount of electricity that is contracted for, Mr. Speaker. The cost will be based on the cost of the project, which will be reviewed by the Utility and Review Board, Mr. Speaker, which, of course, is the way that every project is analyzed for the ratepayer's rate. But the great advantage to this will be that, in addition to that, the extra power will flow through into a competitive market, and then the province of Nova Scotia will have the opportunity to buy the most competitively priced power on the market.
The Honourable Member for Kings West.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yesterday, the Mental Health Commission released a national mental health strategy. For Nova Scotia, this means we now have a national strategy waiting for a response. Recommendations from a provincial advisory committee that have yet to be formulated into a provincial action plan, and DHAs who have been implementing their own mental health strategies all in a vacuum. Could the minister please indicate how the Federal Mental Health Commission strategy will be incorporated with the provincial and DHA strategies?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the Honourable Member for an excellent question. Mr. Speaker, on the working group for Nova Scotia's Mental Health Advisory Committee was a young man whose name is Andy Cox, who's also on the working group for the National Mental Health Strategy. Our co-chair for our working group, our advisory group, Dr. Michael Unger, was also involved with the development of the National Mental Health Strategy. I think, in fact, Nova Scotia probably is the best represented province on the National Mental Health Working Groups. Louise Bradshaw, who is the Executive Director of the Mental Health Commission of Canada, the staff person, is formerly from the Capital District Health Authority and has set up many of the mental health programs in this province. And the Deputy Minister of Health in the Department of Health and Wellness has also been very active on the national file. So we're very aware of what is in the national strategy and are working hard to ensure that that strategy and our own is aligned. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Kings West on his first supplementary.
Thank you, Madam Minister. Unlike the provincial advisory recommendations, the federal strategy comes with a funding recommendation to increase mental health funding from the national average of 7% to 9% of health budgets. Mr. Speaker, when you look at the national average of 7%, Nova Scotia doesn't reach that mark. Our funding is short by over $94 million. To get to 9%, we need to add at least another $171 million. Given the absence of any provincial funding recommendation from the Provincial Advisory Committee, will the Minister of Health and Wellness confirm whether they will be accepting the federal funding recommendations?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Well, first of all, Mr. Speaker, I'm not sure what financial metrics the member is using, but in Nova Scotia, we are either at or very close to 7% of the budget. Well, I hear the member from Clayton Park saying it's not true, but I asked Mr. Speaker, members of my department in the finance to break out where we spend our budget to establish, and in fact, I have that information, and it is the case that we are very close to the 7%. Mr. Speaker, we have indicated that we have set aside close to $4 million for our mental health strategy in the coming year, and we will continue to look at the kinds of resources we need to invest in mental health services as we go forward. The mental health strategy is expected in the next few weeks, Mr. Speaker, and I look forward to having some support in implementing the mental health strategy from all members of this House.
The Honourable Member for Kings West on his final supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, mental health and addiction spending as a percentage of the overall budget is 4.6%, and mental health spending alone as a percentage of the overall budget is 3.5%. And I can table that for the Minister. The final supplementary then: in January, premiers met, formed a healthcare innovation group to look at scopes of practice, human resource management, and clinical practical guidelines. All great directions, but none speak directly to the need for more funding. The report will be discussed in Halifax in July. In March, our Premier was quoted in the Globe and Mail as stating, "Our role as Premiers is not simply to blindly accept whatever the federal government says. Ours is to continue to make the case. I don't think there's a person in the House or even outside this House that doesn't believe that the Premier can't make the case for the federal government to provide more funding for mental health. My question to the Premier, as the new chair of the Federation of the Council, could the Premier please indicate when he will be contacting his respective provincial counterparts to make the case for more federal funding for mental health?"
Honourable the Premier.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm sure the member meant the Council of the Federation. I get his point. In fact, all the premiers are trying to bring to the attention of all Canadians what is happening in healthcare funding generally, which of course reflects very directly on the question of mental health funding. Simple fact of the matter is that although the federal government likes to talk about the 6% escalator, they don't often say that that is only with respect to a very small pool of money that comes from the federal government to the provinces. What that means is that in our province, it amounts to about 1.2% of the healthcare budget in terms of an increase. In fact, the federal government's funding is now, I think this year, will slip below 15% of the total funding for the healthcare system, and we can see very soon it will go down below 10% of the total funding for the healthcare system. This is an extraordinary set of circumstances. So, of course, we intend to argue, intend to push the federal government for additional funding.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton West.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And Mr. Speaker, my question through you will be to the Acting Minister of Economic and Rural Development and Tourism.
There's a $2,000 question.
This government wants to keep the process around the Ship Start Here rule-breaking advertising contract secret. On March the 8th, our caucus, the Progressive Conservative Caucus, submitted a FOIPOP application to the Department of Economic and Rural Development and Tourism asking for the minutes of the Ship Start Here Steering Committee meetings, a group that met a handful of times. On April the 11th, we learned that the department decided to extend the 30-day response time. Now, this is for a simple set of minutes sitting in a binder somewhere, Mr. Speaker. and that the application for an additional 30 days to May 11th, so that we are only a couple of days away from that date. So today, we learned that that won't happen, that the person responsible for meeting the deadline was given time off by this government so that we won't hear the truth, and they don't want to hear the truth before this session is over. So my question to the minister is this. Will the minister ensure that ERDT meets its obligation and delivers the information about ship starts here before the Friday deadline?
Honourable the Minister of Communities, Culture and Heritage.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I know the member opposite is confused about the reasoning for the Ship Start Here campaign, but simply put, Mr. Speaker, this is the biggest economic opportunity the province has ever seen in its history. And what we need is support from all members of this House as we move forward and implement that Ship Start Here campaign and program and the awardment of that ship's contract, Mr. Speaker. This government is supportive of it. I just wish that party over there would support it also.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton West on his first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, my first supplementary will be to the Minister of CNS. Part of Communications Nova Scotia mission is to, working as a team, we bring projects to life from concept to design and budget through to a successful launch. And we learned today that when it comes to the Ship Starts Here, this government kept the concept and design a secret from CNS, but stuffed them with the tab. So my question to the minister is this. If the Ship Starts Here campaign was not a political campaign in nature, why did the government bypass the able professionals at CNS and use an outside agency that is mandated to make a profit and not use CNS, who is accountable to the taxpayers?
The Honourable Minister of the Public Service Commission and Communications, Nova Scotia.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. But to the contrary, Mr. Speaker, we've taken more contracts in the House rather than when that crowd was in government, Mr. Speaker, where they put out. I'm going to tell you something, Mr. Speaker. Since we came to power, at Communications Nova Scotia, Mr. Speaker, the budget has gone down over 27% since we took over, and we picked up what these people put by the curb. We made the difference, Mr. Speaker. We look after the taxpayers' dollars. They wasted them, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton West.
Would be a good waste of breath and time, that answer. Mr. Speaker, this morning the Assistant Deputy Minister told members of the Public Accounts Committee that the Ship Starts Here campaign was intended to instill pride in Nova Scotians.
You never heard the last yet.
She also said, the 811 campaign reaped tangible results by increasing the number of calls to that service. She could not, however, Mr. Speaker, she could not point to one single tangible result stemming from the Ship Starts Here campaign. Now, my question to the minister.
Not one.
Question?
I do have a question. I'm just waiting for the time to get. I don't want the minister to miss it, sir.
That's all right.
Will the minister now admit that the taxpayer-funded Ship Starts Here campaign was little more than a political PR campaign aimed at boosting the political fortunes of a government who has the highest taxes, among the highest power rates, and the second lowest growth rate in the province of
Honourable Minister of Communications, Nova Scotia.
You know, Mr. Speaker, proof that this is working. You know, Mr. Speaker, I've got a picture here, and I'm going to table, and it's not a poster for the blockbuster Three Stooges movie that's coming out this summer, Mr. Speaker, but it is for the member of Argyle, the member from Hants East, and the member from Cape Breton North, standing proudly behind Ship Starts Here logos, Mr. Speaker. That's why it works. They know it works. We know. All Nova Scotia works. Why don't they just agree to us, Mr. Speaker, and we'll move forward?
The Honourable Member for Richmond.
Speaker, yesterday questions were asked to the Minister of Health regarding the protocols used at the Nova Scotia Forensic Hospital dealing with unescorted leave passes. Mr. Speaker, we're now aware that the patient in question who failed to return on Friday night is still missing. In light of the Denny incident mere weeks ago, which led to an unfortunate murder in our province, I'm wondering if the Minister of Health could advise why, in this case, the Minister still waited 72 hours before notifying the public when the patient failed to return.
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, as the Honourable Member knows, there's a criminal review board that reviews the information, the medical information, and makes a determination about individuals with respect to the risk they pose to the community. And they lay out parameters for the doctors and nurses to work within in terms of a treatment plan and a release plan for that individual. And that was the case with this particular young woman. She's been at the forensic hospital for close to a year. She's had numerous passes into the community. She was granted a pass on the Friday in question, and when she failed to return, the procedures that are in place in terms of informing the police were followed, and then subsequently informing the public. And all procedures that exist were followed, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on his first supplementary.
Well, Mr. Speaker, one would say that all the procedures were followed in the Denny incident as well, and we know the most unfortunate result of that case. Mr. Speaker, we've been through this just a few weeks ago, and we've seen what can happen. And today we're now hearing the minister, even after the Denny incident, decided the very protocols she says have been followed are the ones her department is reviewing to see if they're actually the appropriate protocols. But what we now know today, Mr. Speaker, the department waited 72 hours to notify the public. Halifax Regional Police today are saying that they suspect that the patient in question is now in the province of Quebec, which Nova Scotians have to ask, had they been notified earlier, could the public have assisted the police and the government in trying to locate this patient and make sure that she returns to the facility to receive the treatment that she needs? So in light of the fact that Halifax Regional Police now believe that the patient is in the province of Quebec, would the Minister of Health please tell us whether she still believes waiting 72 hours to notify the public was a prudent call?
Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, as I said yesterday in question period, on a daily basis, we may have anywhere between 10 to 15 patients who are at East Coast Forensic receiving some form of leave from the forensic hospital. And these procedures are there to be used in the event that someone leaves the facility and doesn't return. Police are notified within 15 minutes of the failure for an individual to return. If a person is AWOL for a longer period of time, it is their procedure to notify the public within 72 hours. They do have the flexibility to notify the public earlier if they feel that there is a risk to the public, and those decisions are made in consultation with the police department. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on his final supplementary.
Speaker, the facts speak for themselves. We had a system which was brought to Nova Scotians' attention, a system that probably few Nova Scotians even understood how it worked until the Denny incident. The government did react by saying they would order a review, and one would have suspected that the government would have put in place interim measures while waiting for the review to try to ensure that this would not have happened again. Instead, today we're being told that the very same procedures that's currently under review were applied in this case to a patient that we're now being told has made her way to the province of Quebec and is now even further away from receiving the treatment that she deserves. I would add, Mr. Speaker, I would prefer that the Premier would take the safety of patients and the safety of Nova Scotians seriously in this province and implement immediate measures to do so rather than sit and wait until incidents happen and then provide excuses. Mike, you know, Mr. Speaker, order. The Premier again.
Order. 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 The Honourable Member for Richmond has the floor.
No, Mr. Speaker, it's most unfortunate the Premier doesn't take this matter seriously and would not put more attention to this very matter. Mr. Speaker, we've seen a very unfortunate incident. Nova Scotians are now being told to wait for a review, only to see how long that will take before implementing changes. So I would ask the Minister of Health again, in light of this second incident and the fact that we're being told this patient is in the province of Quebec, what immediate changes, temporary changes, will this government implement to try to ensure that these incidents do not happen again?
Honourable the Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Well, Mr. Speaker, in my judgment, it is not appropriate to suspend the treatment of mental health patients in the forensic hospital or the charter rights of mental health patients in a forensic hospital because we had a tragic incident. We all recognize there was a very tragic incident in our community. And we are doing a review of the procedures and we are doing a review of the clinical oversight with respect to what occurred around that incident. But, Mr. Speaker, we have many, many mental health patients in the forensic hospital on treatment plans, subject to the review board, and because we've had this incident, we cannot now say that they will not be able to leave the forensic hospital, to go to school, to work, to visit family, to have a weekend home, or any of those things. These are the treatment plans that are in place, and for most of the people who are in that facility, these treatment plans are working the way they are intended, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Bedford Birch Cove.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, women's organizations are concerned about the specific impact that health policy, namely mental health policy, has on women who experience domestic violence. In a report for the Canadian Women's Foundation, the BC Society of Transition Houses notes that women's experience of violence precipitates their mental health issues. The report revealed that 50% of all women surveyed who had experienced violence had a clinical mental health diagnosis, compared to only 20% of women who had not experienced violence, and I'll table that report. The women's organizations have raised these concerns with the Department of Health and Wellness and in focus groups. Mr. Speaker, can the Minister of Health please tell the members of this House if she has heard the concerns from women's organizations, and if so, was the Mental Health and Addiction Strategy Advisory Committee directed to address these concerns in its recommendations?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the Honourable Member for the question. Domestic violence is certainly of concern to myself and to this government. I am aware of the correlation between mental health disorders and issues and domestic violence. Mr. Speaker, the working group advising on the mental health strategy held public consultations all over the province. Mr. Speaker, they met with more than 1,200 individuals and people representing various organizations, and as I indicated earlier today, their work and recommendations are quite comprehensive, and the strategy will follow quite closely. The department are very much involved across departments, working with justice, status of women, and other departments of government, community services, in having a very comprehensive response to domestic violence in Nova Scotia.
The Honourable Member for Bedford Birch Cove on her first supplementary.
And yet, Mr. Speaker, after all those consultations, the words domestic violence, we can't find them in the report. Women's organizations have concerns about the lack of consideration for domestic violence in the Mental Health and Addiction Strategy Advisory Committee's report. The Domestic Violence Action Plan clearly outlines the connection between domestic violence and mental health. Organizations therefore naturally expected to see something in the mental health strategy recommendations about domestic violence. To the Minister, how has your department addressed the concerns in the Domestic Violence Action Plan that specifically speak to mental health, and will these items be included in the mental health strategy?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the work of the working group is to be congratulated, Mr. Speaker. And I'm not sure if the Honourable Member is suggesting that the working group needed to address every single solitary issue that exists in the province. We have a very comprehensive working group underway across government departments looking at domestic violence and all of the various departments' roles in addressing domestic violence. And I'm sure that as that work unfolds, there will be attention given to access to mental health services and supports for victims of domestic violence as well as perpetrators of domestic violence.
The Honourable Member for Bedford Birch Cove on her final supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So either we're being nitpicky because we asked the Minister to include recommendations on domestic violence, or it's a broad report. I can't really tell because she said both things. Mr. Speaker, women's organizations are concerned about the lack of mention of domestic violence in this report. The Domestic Violence Action Plan is under the purview of the Minister of Justice and the Minister for Status of Women. My question to the Minister of Health: did your cabinet colleagues raise any concern about the lack of mention of domestic violence in the Mental Health and Addiction Strategy Committee's recommendations?
Order, please. You cannot ask questions about the cabinet. It's confidentiality, so I'd ask you to reframe your question and ask it again, please.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Did anyone on the opposite side of the House raise any concern about the lack of mention of domestic violence in the Mental Health and Addiction Strategy Committee's recommendations? Thank you.
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much. Well, Mr. Speaker, as I indicated, this government is very committed to developing good public policy with respect to domestic violence. And to that end, we have a working group across departments, which would include the Department of Health, Community Services, Justice, Status of Women, and so forth, Mr. Speaker. And with respect to the mental health strategy, the working group, the advisory group whose report was tabled last week, it's an excellent report. The strategy will be based on this report. And, Mr. Speaker, the strategy will not be silent with respect to the issues that the member brings up. We are doing multi-sectorial work on a variety of fronts, and we recognize that domestic violence is an area where there is a correlation between mental health issues and violence. And the impact on children, the impact on women, for example, and indeed the need for services for perpetrators of violence against women and children.
The Honourable Member for Bedford, Birds Cove, on a new question.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, in a May 1st article in the Chronicle Herald, the Deputy Premier is reported to have indicated that moving maintenance enforcement programs to positions to New Waterford will improve efficiency, and I'll table that particular article. Now, Mr. Speaker, this is a laudable goal, improving efficiency and bringing jobs to rural Nova Scotia. However, the maintenance enforcement program has been under-resourced and understaffed for years. In fact, the average caseload per worker is 426 active cases. And, Mr. Speaker, that doesn't even include the inactive and the cold cases, Mr. Speaker. Can the Minister of Justice please tell members of this House how relocating a program will improve its efficiency?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Numerous times in this House, the opposition members have raised concern about the structure and format of the MEP and asked my department, asked this government, if we would examine and look at that. What we have done is examined them on an ongoing basis, and we've been over the last 3 years trying to make some fundamental changes. Some of the characteristics that surfaced was the mentoring, the coaching, the training and development of the employees that are providing that service, and bringing them into a cooperative structure where they can have quick exchanges and discuss particular cases. Is the member suggesting to me then that what they were asking earlier, throw that out the window? I'm confused by their questioning. They're either be consistent on their point of view. What we have done is that we have put it in a place where we can achieve those goals and objectives to improve the quality of the system, just as they have asked.
The Honourable Member for Bedford, Birch Cove, on her first supplementary.
Clearly, Mr. Speaker, I'm going to have to get a dictionary out for the minister to explain what the word efficiency means. Mr. Speaker, families in Nova Scotia are owed $81 million in maintenance payments. Maintenance enforcement officers are dealing with overwhelming caseloads, and those enforcement officers know themselves that moving the problem doesn't solve it. In fact, if enforcement officers decide not to go with the program to the other end of the province, we actually lose a wealth of expertise, and new hires will have to start from square one to be trained. So, Mr. Speaker, how is this making the program more efficient, and how is this a better deal for today's families enrolled in the maintenance enforcement program?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Thank you. I'll start off with a line by saying if there's no change, there's no future. If we continue to do the same thing over and over again, that opposition party have said the system wasn't working. So we have made some changes. We're bringing people together in a cooperative manner to be able to mentor and discuss with each other issues that are going on. With the technologies that we have in place today, we're going to be able to automate the system much more quickly and get faster response, control the data information that's coming in to make sure that there's efficiencies. The difference between this government and the opposition is that they just want to spend more money, leave things the way that they are. We want to be constructive, be progressive, and the future starts here.
The Honourable Member for Bedford, Birch Cove, on her final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, the maintenance enforcement program is an under-resourced program. It needs to be fixed. We don't need to move the people around. We need to actually increase the number of enforcement officers who collect the money. In fact, now, money that could be directed to improving that program is going to be eaten up by moving costs. Because, as the minister should well know, you can't move people from one end of the province to the other without having that actually cost money. When the Auditor General suggested changes needed to be made in the program, I don't think this is what he had in mind. Will the Minister of Justice just admit to members of this House that this is simply a job creation program in the riding of the Deputy Premier and not a move to improve the efficiency of the maintenance enforcement program?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Thank you, and I thank the member for that question. The under-resources, it's another example of the difference between this government and the opposition is that this government wants to restructure and make sure that the resources that we have in place are being more efficient and effective. Their idea is just spend more money, hire more people. The other thing that I want to make a distinction is that the opposition clearly does not want to put jobs in the rural area. And I'm very disappointed that they say keep all the jobs in the city of Halifax, but don't give any to rural, especially Cape Breton. Why they're against Cape Breton when they have a number of seats there, I don't know, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Bedford Birchcombe on a new question.
Mr. Speaker, a number of people in Bedford Birch Cove are concerned about the infilling project at the Bedford waterfront. The infilling was approved several decades ago, and most of the lands in the area are owned by the Waterfront Development Corporation, a provincial crown corporation. My question is to the Minister of Environment. Could the Minister please indicate whether all provincial permits were properly obtained for this project at the time, and would those same standards apply if the project were going for approval today?
The Honourable Minister of Environment.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and to the member opposite. I really appreciate the questions concerning the Bedford Waterfront Development Project, and I can assure you that the applications you ask in a kind of a general question, but I can tell you that the jurisdictions that are involved are certain the process that is being followed. And we also know that the Department of Fisheries is involved in this, and also the Halifax Port Authority, and there is an application process through the Nova Scotia environment. And my understanding of this process has been followed to the T, and I can reflect on some other accomplishments that we have done in a short period of 36 months, and I can assure you to the member opposite this project will be the same. Thank you very much for the question.
The Honourable Member for Bedford Birch Cove on her first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, the Waterfront Development Corporation conducted extensive consultations as the plans were drawn up for that waterfront development in Bedford. In fact, Mr. Speaker, the second round of those took place the day after this government was elected. But by the time the final design was presented to the public, considerable negative comments ensued about the lack of green space, proposed heights, and the plan to infill an area with a natural reef. Mr. Speaker, would the minister indicate, is there any requirement for the Waterfront Development Corporation to act on the comments of residents, or can they continue with the development despite a lack of consensus on this plan?
The Honourable Minister of Environment.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And I want to assure the member opposite there is a process in place that there has to be an annual reporting to the Minister of Environment. And again, I want to point out that the infilling is only used proper material, which is clean, environmentally friendly. And this project, like I said, I can relate to a number of environment projects. And we have a great track record of protecting the environment in Nova Scotia. And this project is one of those that we are under our guidance is going to be do the proper thing, protect the environment. Thank you for the question.
The Honourable Member for Bedford Birch Cove on her final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, the Waterfront Development Corporation has indicated that if they stop the project, it will be left as a moonscape on the waterfront. The community of Bedford has accepted tons and tons of peridotic slate from building sites across HRM. Clearly, the community has done HRM and Nova Scotia a service, and yet we're told that we have to accept a development plan that many don't approve of. Mr. Speaker, could the Minister of Environment please explain how taking a substance the rest of the province is trying to get rid of has left my community with an ugly moonscape on the waterfront, development plans that cannot be sustained by the infrastructure in the area, and the possible destruction of several natural habitats?
The Honourable Minister of Environment.
Again, to the member opposite, Mr. Speaker, I want to ensure that only approved fill clean fill will be used for this project. And again, the jurisdictions are the Federal Department of Fisheries and the Halifax Port Authority. There is some guidance there to make sure that this is done in the appropriate manner. And again, I want to emphasize that we're there to protect the environment and to make sure this project is done in the best interest of all Nova Scotians. And I thank you again for the questions.
The Honourable Member for Inverness.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Nova Scotians are more aware than ever that people found not criminally responsible for serious offences have to be absent without permission for 72 hours before the public is allowed to be notified. The Minister of Health, who has a health perspective, staunchly defended withholding this information because she sees it as fundamentally a health issue. This question is for the Minister of Justice because this question is also about the protection of the public. Will the Minister of Justice undertake immediate steps to ensure public safety by advocating a public safety protocol that will allow information to be released immediately when someone who is a possible danger to the public when they're absent?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Thank you, and I want to thank the member for that question. I want to assure the member and all Nova Scotians that I take their safety seriously. I'm very committed. I've spent a lifetime on safety and those issues, and there's protocols in place that we have policies in our institutions. For example, some of this in our, one of our criminal institutions, there are very clear policies that are there. For those that are in our health institutions, there are very clear policies there, and I respect the management and the people that provide those service, and I know that they work very hard to ensure that they comply with their rules, and I have no issue with what's going on there. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Inverness on his first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, we know that the individual that we were speaking about in the legislature yesterday was caught trying to abduct a little boy in Kingston. And I can only imagine what's going on in that little boy's, the minds of the parents of that little boy. This person has been called a risk to herself and others by Capital Health. And if that is the case, people need to know that without an artificial delay. My question to the Minister of Justice, didn't the public in Kings County and elsewhere deserve to know that there was a person at risk to herself and others in their midst?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
I'm going to pass that question over to the Minister of Health because they're talking about a patient from the Health Institute.
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Well, the member started off by making a point that we've learned some things about the mental health system and how people who are in forensic hospitals are patients rather than criminals who have been convicted of any criminal offense. I would also remind members that it's been more than 10 years since the Supreme Court of Canada struck down the practice where people used to be held on lieutenant governor's warrants indefinitely in psychiatric facilities and put in place a process of a criminal review board that would lay out the parameters under which an individual would be kept in a forensic situation, hospital, where an assessment of risk would be done, where a treatment plan would be developed, and where decisions about integrating that person back into the community would be made by competent experts who are psychiatrists and nurses. Mr. Speaker, we don't just make this stuff up. There are well-established laws and practices and protocols that are used all across the country with respect to forensic patients, Mr. Speaker. And the patients who are in East Coast Forensic are there because they indeed have at some point posed a risk, but that risk is not necessarily a risk that is going to continue throughout their entire life, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Inverness on his final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, while I feel for anyone who's suffering from mental illness, this is not just a health issue. An at-large person who is at risk to themselves and the public is first and foremost a public safety issue. Moreover, the system did Andre Denny no favors by reacting sooner, by not reacting sooner. And it is doing this individual no favors by not having done more to get her back into care where she was supposed to be for good medical and safety reasons. Will the Minister of Justice commit to immediately suspending the 72-hour delay rule until something that allows the public to be warned about a danger is put in place?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
I am going to refer this back to the Minister of Health.
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much. Well, Mr. Speaker, it is true that we have to look at these situations with more than a health lens. We have to look at these situations with a balance. We have to look at these situations in terms of public safety. That's why we have a forensic system. And people are in that system, indeed, because they do pose a risk to themselves or to someone else. However, when they're in that system, they're patients. And as I said earlier in question period today, their treatment needs to be determined by trained physicians and nurses, not by politicians on the floor of a legislature. And, Mr. Speaker, we need to be respectful and aware of the fact that these individuals have well-established charter rights that the courts have made decisions on. The highest court in this country, in fact, has made decisions on what their rights are and what the procedures need to be, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Richmond.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I earlier asked a question to the Minister of Health regarding the policies and procedures used by her department regarding the East Coast Forensic Facility when a patient fails to return after they've been given a pass. I believe the Minister has indicated to us the protocols of notifying the police within 15 minutes when the patient does not return, and that there's a 72-hour notification policy to the public if the patient fails to return. I'm just wondering, with the case that we are referring to today, if the Minister of Health could advise us if she is aware whether this was the first time this patient failed to return after being given an escorted day pass.
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And Mr. Speaker, I'm aware that this patient has had numerous passes in the close to a year that she has been in the forensic hospital. I understand that on numerous occasions she has met the conditions of her her leave, and I'm also aware that she hasn't always met the conditions of her leave.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on his first supplementary.
Well, Mr. Speaker, in the interest of full disclosure, allow me to assist the Minister in the matter of the Nova Scotia Review Board regarding the patient in question, which is dated on January 25, 2012. It indicates that the patient returned to the hospital on her own accord on November 2nd, having been AWOL for several weeks. She reported that she had spent some time in Dartmouth and then traveled to Montreal and Edmonton. Mr. Speaker, Halifax Regional Police are now reporting that the patient is believed to be in the province of Quebec. In light of this not having been the first incident, in light of the fact that the AWOL last time was for several weeks, would the Minister of Health explain to us why she waited 72 hours before informing the public that this patient had failed to return yet again?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Well, Mr. Speaker, as I indicated, this patient has been in the forensic hospital for almost a year, has had multiple leaves from the hospital in the past, and the member would know because he has the documentation. He would know that on many occasions the patient has returned, and In other occasions, the patient did not return. The decisions to notify the public are made by the treating psychiatrist and the nurses in consultation with the police. There are protocols in place, and those protocols were followed, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on his final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, it's unfortunate, rather than having full disclosure, that we're having to pick apart the story day by day as more information is being made available. We were led to believe, based on the Minister's responses, that this was a first-time offence and that standard protocols were being followed. Now we have an actual hearing in front of us, which the actual decision, which tells us that this was not the first time. In fact, it tells us that the last time this happened was for several weeks, and that, in fact, the patient traveled outside the province, in fact, to the other side of the country. One would expect that Nova Scotians should be made aware of this, and that the department would have tried to find ways of alerting the public immediately in the hopes that the patient would remain inside the province and be able to return to the facility for care. So in light of all of the information that we now have in this case, does the minister still believe that waiting 72 hours before informing the public of this incident was a wise and prudent public safety decision?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And Mr. Speaker, as I indicated earlier, we have procedures in place to alert the public after an individual has been away for 72 hours. There is the ability for the medical staff who know the individuals consultation with the police to initiate an earlier notification to the public if they believe that the individual poses any significant risk to the public. These are decisions that are made by the nurses and doctors in the forensic service of the province in consultation with the police.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on a new question.
Mr. Speaker, the Nova Scotia Legal Aid Program provides legal representation to low-income Nova Scotians, primarily in the areas of family and criminal law. Those who access legal aid do so because they cannot afford a private lawyer. While the demand for legal aid continues to increase, this government responds with further cuts. Last year, the Minister of Justice cut $553,000 from the legal aid budget. This year, the cut has been $184,000 for a two-year reduction of legal aid budget by the NDP government of $737,000. My question is, will the Minister of Justice explain to Nova Scotians why he's again cutting funding to the legal aid program?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Every department has a responsibility to work more efficiently and effective in trying to get ourselves back to balance. And the one area that came forward was that I compliment the staff and the all workers within the legal aid system for doing a very good part in bringing their costs under control. I also had recent discussions with my federal counterparts to look at ways of where there should be a more progressive funding from the federal formula in regards to legal aid. So we're looking at all avenues in which to be able to fund our initiatives.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on his first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, one of the main barriers for Nova Scotians accessing legal aid is the income cap that determines who will qualify. This is a long-standing issue in this province. In fact, it was raised on November 18, 2008, by the MLA for Fairview, now the Minister of Finance, while in opposition, where he said, quote, "Because legal aid rates, for example, the qualifying income for legal aid is so low now that essentially anybody who's working doesn't qualify for legal aid. Even if you're working full-time at minimum wage, you would still earn too much to qualify for legal aid." So you have this whole stratum of society that doesn't qualify for legal aid and yet can't afford a lawyer, and there's an enormous gap in between those two. Mr. Speaker, since the Minister of Finance increased 1,400 user fees last year to reflect the cost of living increases, will the Minister of Justice explain why, after three long years, the NDP government has not increased the cap, the income cap, to access legal aid?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the member for the question. Fairness and equity in the system is an important ingredient. I couldn't agree more that we have to find ways to balance that fairness out, and that whole issue of the cap is being reviewed. I can't overlook the fact that when you put a new government in place and you leave a legacy of over $13 billion worth of deficit, and then you come as an opposition party and your whole theme is hire more people, spend more money, and don't come forward with constructive points of view. I agree the cap has to be looked at, and as I said in my earlier answer, that we are looking at discussing with my federal counterparts, but I also like the opposition to come forward with some consistent message on spending and what ideas they'd like to have instead of just hire more people, spend more money. We have our priorities in space. We want to invest more in crime prevention and not in detention.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on his final supplementary.
Well, I'm sure hearing the Minister of Justice say he wants to invest more in crime prevention will help all the mothers out there that are trying to get out of abusive relationships and trying to access legal aid to do so. I'm sure they will find that very reassuring. And it's so interesting to hear the Minister of Justice upset about recommendations being made by the opposition when I just gave him that quote from the Minister of Finance while he was in opposition. So allow me to help the Minister of Justice again. The member for Cole Harbour, who is now the Premier, was concerned about legal aid when he was in opposition. In fact, on March 20, 2007, he said, quote, "There also needs to be additional money in legal aid services to allow people who are unable to afford the services of a lawyer to get access to those services as well, because the system really functions much more efficiently when the people who are caught up in the system have fair access to those resources." So while in opposition, the Premier thought that access to legal aid was an important issue. My question to the Minister of Justice, why now, 3 years in their mandate, is access to legal aid no longer a priority?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Thank you, and I want to just go over some of the points that the Honourable Member has made there. He made the accusations about mothers that are being abused and getting supports. I can't stress enough the importance about domestic violence and ensuring that the population of Nova Scotia, that this government is very sensitive. That's why we got the pilot project in Cape Breton with the domestic violence court. That's why we're looking at the mental health court. That's why we're taking on these types of initiatives. It's not just about putting money in one place. And the member of the opposition there did stress to taking priorities, putting the money wisely. We put them in those areas, and that will make a difference for mothers in this community that are being abused. We believe in the safety of all Nova Scotians.
The Honourable Member for Bedford Birch Cove.
Mr. Speaker, members of the Community Services Committee recently heard from restorative justice agencies across the province. These agencies have been able to divert 17,000 cases from the courts in the past 10 years. We've also heard they're required by their service agreement with the Department of Justice to provide services for which they receive no funding from this government. So my question to the Minister of Justice, can the Minister please explain how it is fair that a department can require an agency to provide a service if the department doesn't fund the agency?
Order, please. The time allotted for oral questions put by members to minister has expired. I will now recognize the host leader of the Progressive Conservative Party.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Can you call private members' public bills for second reading?
Private members' public bills for second reading. The Honourable The Honourable Host Leader for the Progressive Conservative Party.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Can you call Bill number 72, the Capital Projects Review Act?
Bill number 72, the Capital Projects Review Act. I will now recognize the Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I take great pleasure in rising to speak on this important bill, a bill that the Progressive Conservative Caucus has been calling on the government to take action on for months and months now. In the absence of any action by the government, a bill that the Progressive Conservative Caucus brought forward, introduced into this House, and is